My favorite thing about Bill Mitchell and When Dating Hurts podcast is the opportunity to share my voice and my story. I think that no matter where you are in listening about someone else's situation or sharing your own, that being within a community of listeners where it's safe to share a voice is invaluable. Thank you, Bill.
When Dating Hurts podcast continues to grow in popularity, the more who listen, the more who will know the realities of dating and domestic violence. In the meantime, the When Dating Hurts book, in paperback, ebook, and audiobook, is being purchased and read by concerned parents, teachers, victims and survivors, and of course, those who are currently dating. Education leads to empowerment. That way, if a potential abuser is targeting you or someone you care about, you will know how to detect it and how to break free and stay safe. Up next, another survivor story to illustrate how an innocent person can become manipulated and trapped in abusive relationships. Deborah's story takes us to places many of us have never been before. She spent time in the Navy and then in the Army. We go to San Diego, California, then Kentucky, and then over to Afghanistan before returning to the U.S. Before heading to Afghanistan, Deborah meets Scott, who does a brilliant portrayal of being everyone's best friend while winning over Deborah's heart. This story does well in showing how a narcissist can take on many disguises and fool people. But when a narcissist is called out or is not being obeyed, life can become both turbulent and dangerous. Here's Deborah's story, part one of two parts. Today we'll be speaking with Deborah, who's going to tell us her story. She has done a lot of work already in this area. She hasn't told her entire story in its entirety until now. And we're really happy to have her, but she does have her story committed on a website, and she'll tell us about that. I just want to come out now and say, hey, Deborah, welcome to the When Dating Hurts podcast. Really good to see you.
Hi, Bill. Thank you so much for having me. This is really hard for me, but it's so important as well, and I just really appreciate it so much.
I appreciate it just as much. I really do. I just want to refer for a moment to your email. I thought that it was the way you found us was you were on some kind of a, I guess, driving road trip somewhere and bumped into this podcast.
I was driving back from my parents in Pennsylvania. I'm still in the military. I'm an Army reservist, and I was picking my son back up from my parents while he was staying while I was at annual training. And so that's a 16 plus hour drive. And so as we were all driving back, I was trying to find something interesting. I need to do some more research. I need some more topics for my blog, and I need to get back in that headspace. And I found your podcast almost right away. Immediately, there was so much validation, which I know has made it such a popular podcast for people that have experienced these things. The validation is what makes them want to continue to pursue learning more and educating themselves more. They may just be getting into this. This may be the first avenue that they've gone down when they're trying to figure out what has happened to them and how many others has it happened to.
Yes, it's an unfortunate thing that it is as prevalent as it is. When it happens to, it seems like most people I've spoken with, when they are finding themselves being lowered into the pit of domestic violence, they do feel like this is happening to me. I don't understand it. I don't know who to turn to. They go through all those things that anybody would. You know, they feel very much isolated and alone. And that's exactly what the abuser, the perpetrator, wants that person to feel. They don't want them to be thinking outside of the relationship, which is getting worse by the day. So I'm very happy that you found us. So Deborah, where would you like to enter into your story?
I do want to start with my upbringing. I do think that it's very important for this particular topic, which is based a lot around the military and the military community. I was born in Long Beach, California, in a military hospital. I spent a lot of time in California. My father was a naval helicopter pilot. My mother was a journalist in the Navy. She was a reservist at the time, so she was enlisted and he was an officer, which is kind of a no-no. But if one of you is in the reserves, they don't seem to care so much. Being in the naval aviation community, it's a tight-knit community. It's smaller than the shipboard community.
Would you call it a little bit of a boys' club, too? Or is that not fair?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially in the 80s. And we were all over. He went to Naval War College twice, once when I was a baby, and then went back to teach. And that's in Newport, Rhode Island. Every couple years, I was going to a new school. I was meeting new kids, making friends. I had gotten so good at it. Some of the negative effects were that I knew I didn't have to make a very good impression for long. So by the time I knew I was leaving, I didn't care who I pissed off anymore, because I was like, bye bye. I do remember telling a lot of the same stories to try to make myself seem cooler to kids that I was just meeting. So, yeah, that absolutely applies.
How about that?
My parents had me when they were a little bit older. My mother was 36 when she gave birth to me. By the time I was like 12, my dad was at his last duty station in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, at the Army War College, and that was his last position, was a teaching position before he retired. And that was by design. He wanted to be in Gettysburg. He wanted to retire here. He wanted to be a guide, and he loves it. I started junior high here, and I knew I couldn't pull my previous stunts because I was going to go to junior high and high school here all the way through. So I kind of went the other way. I became kind of a people pleaser.
Why do you think that is?
So I'm in graduate school right now to be a marriage and family therapist. And I'm doing self-evaluations at the same time. And that's why the military situation is so interesting to me. At some point, even though I had a very supportive parents, very wonderful parents, I grew up in a normative, healthy situation throughout my entire childhood. No really significant traumas to speak of. I'm guessing that just not having your normal extended family around, friends that you grow up with your whole life, there may be some bit of a fear of abandonment there, even though I was the one doing the leaving all of the time. It was still not really my choice.
But there are these disconnects, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I think it had something to do with that. And I look forward to doing a little bit of more research in that area, because I think that military brats have an interesting developmental situation of their own that hasn't gotten enough attention. There's a lot of gaps still in research. And I don't like performing research because I'm not much of a math person, but that looks like it's a big part of my future. I went in a psychology direction because the what isn't nearly as important to me as the why. So there I am in Gettysburg. All of my friends in junior high and high school were the outcasts. I was happy about that at the time. I was the good one. I guess you'd call the good one. They're all using experimental drugs and all nonconformists. I still keep up with a lot of those people because they ended up being the ones with the most interesting adulthoods as well. They were the least indoctrinated of all of the people that I graduated with. That ended up being a real plus when it came to future friendships, even though they had some troubled childhoods. The last year of high school, I was in what's called the delayed entry program. The recruiter is kind of prepping you for boot camp, and not so much in a physical training way, although they encourage you to train as much as you can before you go.
You might want to get in shape before you go, when you go chugging around a field somewhere, yeah, panting, that doesn't have a good look to the instructors.
Right. They expect that at these national training centers in the different branches. The drill instructors know that a lot of people haven't done any training before that. They're working from scratch for the most part. But they do, when you're in that delayed entry program, try to get you into that headspace. And so they'll get you to memorize some things that they know you're going to have to learn when you get to boot camp anyway, rank system, all of those things. And so I already knew what I was going to do. I had somewhat of a self-esteem problem when it came to academics. I don't know why that is. The 80s and 90s were a very interesting time for ADHD. Our medications weren't great. When I was in fifth grade, my school nurse thought I had anorexia because I was never hungry. But that's what Ritalin does. I spent a lot of time, you know, trying to deal with these side effects. When you're in that delayed entry program, you're not allowed to be on any of those things. I don't know about currently, but in 1999, if you had been on Ritalin any time in the past 365 days, they did not want you going to boot camp. I think they didn't know enough about what these pharmaceuticals were doing to the not completely developed mind. And there were some concerns among the leadership in the military, the medical community in the military, that this could be a negative thing later. I basically had to raw dog my way through my senior year with nothing helping me focus. I barely graduated and I never missed a day. I never skipped. It was horrible for my self-esteem. And so I said, that's it. I'm not going to college. I'm not putting myself through anything more like this. Little did I know I was going to end up doing my undergraduate completely online 10, 15 years later and graduating summa cum laude. I even turned down the GI Bill when I first got to boot camp because I was so sure I was not going to go to college. Luckily, they came out with this post 9/11 GI Bill after 2001, and I got it anyway, whether I wanted it or not. And I am still using it.
That's very good. Good for you.
I am still using it. The military finished raising me in many different ways. I've had conversations with my son about that a lot lately because he's like, I'm not going to school anymore. I'm not going to college. And I said, this sounds very familiar, but he wants to be in the Army. He wants to play infantry for a couple of years. And so I told him, like, look, just get the GI Bill. Whether you're going to use it or not, you can give it to your kids. You know, you can give it to your spouse later. You don't have to use it yourself. So
yeah, I didn't realize that. You can give it to your spouse, huh?
Mm-hmm. I can give it to my husband, but I'm using it. So me going in the military, it was good. The first few years were great. I didn't have, Bill, I've just been very blessed. I guess I have this personality, this don't mess with me or I'll tell on you kind of personality, because I never had some leader behind some closed door try to hit on me, or none of those types of things ever happened to me. So I was just either, you know, in the right place or the right time, and depending on your theology, I guess. But I believe that everything happens for a reason. So that's my take. I did have a first marriage that was interesting. I met this man when I was stationed in San Diego. I was on an aircraft carrier at the time because I was in the Navy first, the biggest thing you can stand on that moves on this earth. I was doing personnel work at the time, record keeping. So when somebody got married, you know, they would come bring me their marriage certificate. I would update their pay and all of that stuff. And that's what I did for the Navy. But that was a very quiet few years, with the exception of 9/11. Which is, you know, a whole other thing. I got to San Diego and I checked into this dentist, and one of the first friends that I met there, this young man had gone through his job training with a couple other young men who went to other ships that were also docked there. And so we all went to meet at a mall, and I met my first husband through him. He was a very troubled young man. I need to mention this one. This one was definitely an overt narcissist.
This first one?
Yes, absolutely. He came from a wealthy background, but he had messed things up so many times. And the late 90s, and a couple times since, has been that go to jail or go in the military opportunity. You may have heard about it before.
How does that work?
So a lot of counties and a lot of court situations, as long as it's not, you know, aggravated assault kind of things, things that you really need to be behind bars for. If you keep getting in trouble and you're of a certain age, you know, military age, as they'd say, 18 to 24, they'll say, well, the recruiter here has been authorized to recruit people in this situation. We'll allow this to be a rehabilitating option for you. Oh. You can go to jail or you can go in the military. And that actually happened with Scott later too.
The next fellow. Okay.
Both of these men that I was married to entered the military for basically the same reason.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out. I could no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get 6,000 cash, give us each 3,000, we give you this. Uh-huh. You go home and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done, and that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com or wherever fine podcasts are found.
So my first husband had some drug issues that I didn't know about. We were only together for a few years. I knew when I got out of that, I did what was called the blue to green program. So I decided that I didn't want to be in the Navy anymore, but I had this opportunity to go into the Army and get away and file for divorce at that same time. I knew what I didn't want in my life anymore. Because we know, you know, the overt narcissists, once you know what you're dealing with, you know, they're the easiest to identify. A lot of people don't care for them. They're in a class of their own, I'd say. I was looking for anything but that. And so that's what kind of brings you to me still not knowing what healthy was. I knew what I didn't want, but I didn't know how to... I didn't know how to cultivate something healthy. I just knew what I didn't want. And so often you hear about these women, especially being with one or the other at some time in their life. They're with an overt and then they're with an overt because this one was so different than the other. They're like, oh, thank goodness, not the other.
But they just do such a great job of camouflaging it that you don't realize that it's a variation on the same theme. It just has a better mask on it.
And they're both very charismatic.
But let's stay with that for just a second. They're charismatic, but it's an act to bring you in, and then they'll turn it off like a switch.
They're what they think people want.
Yes. It's a portrayal.
Yeah. Well, and from whatever age they had to start adopting this identity because they didn't have one. For whatever reason, that, you know, their original identity was never given to them. And so they have to create this. They make up this character. By the time they get to a certain age, they have really honed, you know, this character is very well defined for them. And it's fluid. It takes on whatever it needs to take on based on what the supply they're going for at the time looks like. But they know what works. So I knew what I didn't want. I went off to Army boot camp, fresh start.
So you actually do boot camp again. I mean, you have to do kind of basic training all over, even though you've done it once.
At the time, this was 2005. It was like a consolidated, they called it prior service boot camp. And it was something that they did for a little while. It was kind of an experimental program. So they took people that didn't have any field experience. So if you were Navy or Coast Guard or Air Force, you had to go through that. If you had been Army before or a Marine before and were coming back in, you did not have to do that because you'd had practically the same training. So because this was very new for Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, they wanted to make sure that we didn't have any gaps in that training, things we didn't understand, especially when it came to weapons. We had had very little or no rifle familiarization at all. So I joined the Army in 2005. I decided to go in a different direction because I didn't want to be a paper pusher anymore. I wanted to choose a trade that I could always do for the rest of my life, no matter what. And I chose welding. Trades are a wonderful thing for anybody. I think women really need to consider going into trades. Woodworking, metalworking, electrical, plumbing, all of these things. There will always be jobs, no matter what economy we're in, for these things. And if you don't know what to do for a little while, and there's a community college that you can learn a little bit about any of these things, take advantage of it. Absolutely. It was one of the best educations that I've ever gotten. Not that I'm not loving what I'm currently doing. So I went through a welding school in Aberdeen Proving Grounds. And then I went to Fort Campbell, Kentucky. I loved it so much that I ended up buying a house while I was there. And then 1st Infantry Division decided to stand their 3rd Brigade back up from nothing. They had basically decommissioned this whole brigade after World War II. Well, it's Afghanistan time, and we're going to start using this brigade again. But now there's nobody in it. So now we're just going to pull people from all over the Army to come to Fort Hood to be part of this brigade that we're going to use again. Guess who had just bought a house and then had to leave it? I was pretty upset about that. I rented it out ever since to people that needed to rent a place while they were stationed there. So, and I did sell it in 2001 when that APR was wonderful for buying and selling. It did benefit me. So then I went to Fort Hood in 2007 and we spent a year training, and then we deployed to Afghanistan in the summer of 2008. I was in a light infantry battalion within that brigade. And what that means is these are all foot soldiers, infantry boys, and there were about 1,000 of them. And then my company was the support for that. Fuelers, truck drivers, cooks, all of that type of support, mechanics. When we went there, they put our headquarters very, very far out in the middle of nowhere. And so we had to have a few mechanics out there and one welder, who was me. Just before we had gotten there, we got one new soldier to our company who ended up being Scott. So I didn't know him at all before we deployed. I hadn't even met him. Meeting somebody that has these qualities that needs to win you over, and we know how they go about doing it. In a place like that, these dynamics are a little bit different, but you can't get away. There's no, I need to go home for the night and I'll call you. Maybe I won't call you. There's no calling. You always knew where to find me.
There's no getaway.
There's no getaway.
Because you are stuck. You're right there. You're getting a steady diet of Scott.
Yes. Yes. And so he took full advantage of that. If I was in the gym, suddenly he was in the gym. Mm-hmm. If I was going to the chow hall to eat, he was either already in there because he had obviously memorized my schedule. He was a decent mechanic, even though his job was a fueler. So he would often come up to the shop and help the mechanics that I worked with. And then obviously in order to talk to me and to get to know me better.
How did you feel about him when you saw him? I mean, was it, for instance, oh my God, here he is again? Or is it like, hey, wow, here he is again?
It was a little bit of both because he was definitely a show off. He was younger than me by like 6 years. So he was about 21 at the time. He was really into bodybuilding, but he wasn't like I was kind of saying before, he wasn't this overt, he didn't have this overt personality. He seemed to still want to interact with everybody around him in a give and take way. He would give compliments and take them graciously, and he knew how to get people to like him. Everybody liked him. He would take extra time to help people outside of what he was doing already. He knew that it gave him a particular image. That's still to this day. That is still to this day.
That's why it's so difficult, because that makes somebody so attractive. It seems like he's selfless. He's generous with his time, goes out of the way. I mean, everybody could look at everybody and say, wow, I really, it's good to have him around. He's a positive influence. I mean, everybody kind of gets tricked.
So much so that you're not even sure if they would do it without an audience. One time, years later, we were on a road trip, and this bird, it was storming, and this bird just crash lands on the side of the freeway, and he pulls over and grabs this bird and hands it to me and says, start Googling animal protection places or something. Where can we take this bird? And it had a broken wing, and you almost never hear stuff like this. You always hear the bad, but where is their mind when they're doing these things? Was it just for me, and why? And so I have to put it in the context of that time. What was going on at that time that he may have really needed to make a good impression on me at that moment? You always have to consider the context when these things are happening. Later that day, something not so great happened, or earlier that day, something not so great happened. But if you just look at these things without the context, you can just take the good and think that these are wonderful people.
You're right. If you just cherry pick those moments, you'd say this guy is St. Francis of Assisi here with these animals.
This is the guy that stops and moves turtles out of the road so they don't get run over. There's people, you know, that we mutually know who to this day believe that he would give them the shirt off of his back. And he would in front of an audience. You know, it makes you wonder. So we were talking about how we think everything happens for a reason. Why God allows people to be this way? What is their purpose for being this way? Do they have a purpose? Can it be a positive thing? As long as people know where their boundaries need to be, so that person isn't able to hurt anybody, but they still have this purpose because they have this need that they need to meet. And that's a hard thing to even consider or wrap your mind around when these things have happened to you on the other end. When you're the abused, you can't see any of that as ever being a good thing. These people are completely evil. And at some point, we're going to have to consider how healthy that is, how healthy that mindset is, and how productive it is. So, but there's that.
You're seeing a version of him. You're seeing this appealing version of him at times. What do you imagine he saw in you during that time period? Why you?
Because I was everything that he understood as being what you're supposed to be with. And that's a good thing. I'm responsible. I've always been very good with my finances. In all humility, though, I'm a well-rounded person.
So you're a great foundation for him.
Yeah. And I'm an extrovert. I have a very high amount of empathy. I'm sometimes overly concerned about those around me, and I have to keep reminding myself that it's not my circus and it's not my monkeys on a daily basis. That I can only do so much, but the fixers often end up with these people. It's maybe one of our greatest qualities, but also one of our biggest weaknesses too, depending on how you look at it. Him and I had lots of talks when we were still sitting there looking at some of the most beautiful mountains in the world in Afghanistan. And he talked a lot about his upbringing and his pain from being a kid and growing up the way he did. His mother was, he never really had a mother. When he was very young, his mother had some drug problems. And so his dad, or at least this is what his father said, His dad got full custody of him when he was about three. His father doesn't seem to care about the welfare of women at all. And so he never taught his son how to really have any respect for women or how they should be treated, except for what he showed, which was a bunch of short-lived relationships that never ended very well. And so he just didn't have a very good example from his caregiver as to what a healthy relationship looked like, should look like, or how to treat somebody that you're in a relationship with. I was constantly surprised throughout our relationship that he was acting as well as he was under those circumstances. He did have a family that he would go stay with sometimes for reasons that I never knew later. When he was a kid, he would go stay with grandparents, mom's parents or dad's parents, and they gave him a little bit better of an example than his dad did. But these were these were infrequent things. So mostly it was this man who acted more like a friend than a father. The dynamic is very interesting. This is a very controlling man, his father. Still to this day, it seemed to me like he was wanting to move forward from all that and wanted a family and wanted to continue in the military and maybe make a career out of it. I didn't really see any red flags at that time when we were still there. But that's why this is so unique, because there was really not much of a break there. We were very isolated there together. I didn't meet any family. We're just out there in this foreign country where there was a lot missing from the picture when you first meet somebody in a situation like that.
An artificial way to live. It won't look like that in the States.
No.
You know, the give and take. When you're there, you know what you're wearing every day.
I didn't see how he acted behind the wheel of a car. I was missing a lot of context. I didn't see how he paid his bills or what his spending habits were. There's all these things that you don't see because you're in this very unique situation.
Yes.
So when we were redeploying to come back, I found out I was pregnant the week we got back.
This ends Deborah's story, part one. Be looking for part two on the When Dating Hurts podcast. Thank you for listening to the When Dating Hurts podcast. We have been steadily moving up in podcast review rankings based on downloads in the relationships category. That means more and more listeners are getting the kind of advice that can improve lives for victims, survivors, and their families. If you feel we need to hear your story, do not hesitate to email me at BillMitchell@WhenDatingHurts.com. That's BillMitchell@WhenDatingHurts.com. Hi, it's Bill Mitchell. I'm proud to say the When Dating Hurts podcast is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. To learn more about Evergreen Podcasts or to check out other shows on the Evergreen Network, just visit evergreenpodcasts.com.